Good morning, I'm Michael Cathcart, and you're so very welcome to Books and Arts Daily here on RN. And today, you and I are at the Melbourne Writers' Festival. Let's cross to the stage now, where I'm about to introduce my guest, Sir Salman Rushdie. Hello and welcome to this very special event at the Melbourne Writers' Festival. I'm Michael Cathcart, the host of Books and Arts Daily on RN. So we're here today to meet Salman Rushdie, perhaps the most famous novelist in the world. He was born in Bombay. His second novel, Midnight's Children, won the Booker Prize in 1981. And since then, it's been pretty much plain sailing. Oh, there was that incident. Yes, the trouble with his novel, The Satanic Verses, which was published 7 years after that Booker Prize win. As we all know, the book outraged the religious leader of Iran, the Ayatollah Khomeini, who denounced the book as a blasphemy against Islam. The Ayatollah placed a bounty on Salman's head, and he went into hiding under the protection of the British Secret Service. And he's told the story of those years in a large and very candid memoir called Joseph Anton. Would you welcome Salman Rushdie to Melbourne? So let's start at the beginning before we get to the juicy bit. You're born in Bombay, now called Mumbai, in 1947, just a few months before these two nations, India and Pakistan, come into being. Can you tell us about the city of your childhood? What sort of place was it?
You know, one of the strange things about growing up in a city, especially a great big city, is you sort of assume that the city's always been there. You know, you assume that it's been there for a long time. But actually, Bombay was quite a young city at the time. It's not one of the ancient cities of India like Delhi or Calcutta. You know, it's a city that the British built in India. And, you know, originally there was a fort there, and gradually the fort grew into what's still called the district called Fort, which is a sort of downtown area. And now it's sort of exploded. But it was quite a young city. And famous at the time for its atmosphere of tolerance. And of course it is the big cosmopolitan city because it's the city that faces west, you know, so it's the big port. There's a lot more non-Indians in Bombay than anywhere else in India. Also, Bombay stands on a kind of borderland inside India. I mean, everything north of Bombay is North India. Everything south of Bombay is South India. And so all kinds, it has a great diversity of Indians who are there, you know, which is really unlike the other big cities. I mean, if you're in Delhi, you essentially see people from the north. If you're in Calcutta, the population is almost entirely Bengali. And if you're in Madras, it's very, very substantially Tamil. But Bombay is everyone. You know, so it has that enormous cosmopolitanism, both of different kinds of Indians and of the kind of engagement with the world. That was kind of great. I mean, my neighborhood growing up as a kid, we had, you know, Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Christians, Buddhists, kids from Bengal and Madras and North India and Sweden and America and England and et cetera. And that was just the atmosphere in which you grew up.
So when the partition happened in the year of your birth, your family, who were Muslim, weren't under any pressure to...
Well, my family, you see, weren't... For a start, yes, they were technically Muslim, but they were not very Muslim. You know, I mean, my father certainly wasn't at all, and my mother really. The limit of my mother's Islam was that you weren't supposed to eat pig. Right. You know, that was the rule. And as long as you didn't eat pig, the rest of the religion didn't really...
You'd tick the right box.
Didn't really feature, yeah. There was an awful moment in my childhood when my mother decided, for weird reasons, that my sisters and I should have some religious instruction. And she hired a teacher, a Molvi, as he's called, to come and teach us. You know, my sisters were all rather wicked and made terrible fun of him. And he complained to my parents that we were not taking this seriously, that my sisters were teasing him. I, unfortunately, thought that I was the goody-goody who didn't tease him, I am ashamed to say. But my sisters made up for it. And my parents, when he complained to them, kind of defended my sisters, you know, and didn't stand up for him. And so he flounced off in a rage, and that was the end of religion in our house, except for the ham thing. So the reason I say this is that when the partition of India was approaching, my parents were at that time living in Delhi. And Delhi was, very unlike Bombay, it was a place which was thought likely to be some kind of communal flashpoint, and in fact was. And my father decided, A, that he didn't want to go to Pakistan because he didn't want to live in a theocratic state, and B, that it was probably a good idea not to stay in Delhi. And so they moved to Bombay just the year before I was born, because they thought that everything would be calm there. And indeed, so it was. You know, the troubles the terrible troubles of partition happened elsewhere. They more or less didn't happen in Bombay. So I grew up in what at that time was a very communally contented world in which we just, you know, as kids, we just had everybody's holidays, you know, because it was just a way of having more holidays. And there was no sense of exclusion. You know, I mean, one of the big festivals in Bombay every year is the festival of Ganesh, you know, who's the elephant-headed god. Ganesh Chaturthi, or Ganpati as it's called, was a great celebration, and everybody joined in. You didn't have to be a Hindu to join in. You just joined in because it was fun. Amongst many things that has changed in the transition from Bombay to Mumbai is the loss of that intercommunal tolerant spirit. You know, it's really become much more, there's much more conflict now, largely generated by a large, long period of Hindu nationalist governments.
Does that suggest to you that there are times when religions are very formalized and we know that I'm part of this religion rather than part of that religion, and there are other times when religions are a bit more fluid and people take bits and pieces of different kind of practice?
Well, it's just, I think there are times when religion's not that important, you know, and I think my generation growing up both in India and England, it would never have occurred to us that there would be a time when religion would move back into the center of the stage and begin to kind of define what went on in the world. I mean, it's all right. There are people who had religion and believed in it and went about their business doing so, and that was, you know, silly, but fair enough. But the idea that it would become the dominant force in public life, you know, again, nobody would have given that serious consideration, you know, and the generation of the 60s, how wrong we were. While we were busy doing all that 60s nonsense, you know, this force that we had discounted gradually crept back into the reckoning and you know, as we now see, is a very large force to be reckoned with.
So let's jump forward a little to when you're 13, because you leave home and you go to the very exclusive rugby school in Warwickshire, which I visited when I was a child. It's a very posh place indeed. It's got these lovely rugby ovals that seem to go, well, not ovals, pitches that seem to go forever. And then the buildings are like castles, aren't they, with sort of battlements.
Well, some of them are,
around the top.
I mean, as always with boys' boarding schools, the posh is all on the outside.
Right.
I mean, the inside bit is really rather more like jail than anything else. But yeah, I mean, it's also different now, because in those days it was a boys only school. I mean, there was like almost 1,000 boys and no girls. And now it's like most of those schools, it's now pretty fully co-educational. I mean, actually, the boarding house that I stayed in is now a girls' boarding house. So that's been a big change, and I think has been a very civilizing change, you know, because I think anybody who looks at, you know, kids in school knows that that girls have a civilizing effect on boys, you know. I'm not sure how good it is for the girls, but the boys behave better when there are girls around. And I mean, when I was there, they still used to beat children, you know, and they still had fagging. All these things that seemed to belong to the 19th century were still going on at rugby school in the early 60s.
Were you beaten?
I got very close to it, but I'm sorry, I was a very good kid. I've made up for it later. There was actually a very nice moment just after the attack on the Satanic Verses began, when some British television reporter went and unearthed my old history teacher at school, now kind of elderly and living in retirement, but they found him somewhere. And he said, who'd have thought such a nice, quiet boy could get into so much trouble?
you have said that it's at rugby that you discovered that you were Indian.
Yeah.
What did you mean?
No, I mean just that I was foreign.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, you grow up, you don't think of yourself as foreign. You know, you think of yourself as yourself. And it's only when I got to England that I discovered that there was this sense that I was a kind of other, you know, that I wasn't one of them. I was other.
Yeah.
And I think I said it somewhere in the book that it struck me that at the boys' boarding school, there were three unforgivable sins. And you could get away with two of them, but not all three. And the three unforgivable sins are being clever, foreign, and bad at games. If you're clever and foreign, but you're a brilliant cricketer, all is forgiven.
Right.
If you're clever and bad at games, but you're not foreign, then you get away with it, and so on. You know, you could get it, but I had the triple whammy, you know.
And did that shake your self-confidence? Because one of the things that's stunning about you is that through thick and thin, you have been a man of astonishing self-confidence.
I don't know, is that so? Might look like, that might be like rugby school, it's on the outside. No, I was very unhappy at school.
So you're a lost little boy, are you?
Yeah, and I lied to my parents because I thought they've sent me all this way and, you know, it's costing them all this money and I shouldn't... So I would write them these letters that were my first real fictions, you know. you know, had a great week, scored 23 not out, etc. I have to say, one of the great things about being here in Australia is that one can mention cricket and people know what the hell you're talking about. You know, try saying 23 not out in New York. You know, nobody knows what is that.
No, what, you stayed in? They wouldn't let you go to the dance?
No, exactly. Exactly. Anyway, so, yeah, and it was only after I left school, really, that I told them how unhappy I'd been, and they were absolutely horrified. And kind of mortified and said, why didn't you tell us? You know, we'd have yanked you out of there, and et cetera. But for some strange...
And we were shelling out all this dosh.
Yeah, exactly. Well, for some strange adolescent reason, I didn't tell them, you know. And it also got... It sort of got better because the bad part was when I was... the bottom end of the school is where you always have the most trouble. You know, as you get up to the top end of the school, it's, you know, A, people have grown up a bit, and B, you're bigger than other people. You know, but it was not a good experience. And in fact, I really didn't want to go to university in England. You know, and when I told my parents, I said, look, you know, I already had a place at Cambridge at that point. And I said, don't send me, you know, I'll go to college here. I mean, I don't want to go back there. And my father had been at King's Cambridge, which is where I had been given a place. And he was very keen that I should go back. So he eventually persuaded me to go. And I'm actually very glad he did, because Cambridge was exactly the opposite experience of what rugby had been. You know, it was open and tolerant and diverse. And this was, you know, this was 1965. I mean, this was the historical epicenter of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, you know, 65 to 68.
Yeah.
And there we are. That's when I was at
Cambridge. And you studied history. Why did you choose history?
Well, I was, you know, history was, I'd got in on history when I did history A-levels, and I was interested in history. And I think that it's been very significant in the kind of books that I've written, you know, because I think what history encourages you to ask all the time is the relationship between our individual ordinary lives and the big sphere of public events, you know, and how those two interact, and whether it's possible for us as individuals or as groups of individuals to make a difference, to make it have an impact on the world in which we live, or whether we're simply, you know, the victims of power and its movements.
Which is what Midnight's Children is about. I mean, Midnight's Children is really a history book.
Well, it's interesting. When it came out, it had such a different... I mean, fortunately, people liked it, which I was not at all certain that they would, but they did. But they liked it very differently. Let's say Western readers and Indian readers liked it very differently. I mean, the Western readers tended to like it for its more fantastic, fabulated elements. That's the stuff that people noticed and wrote about. In India, people did basically treat it like a history book. I remember going there shortly after the book came out, and I did a little sort of tour in various cities. And in Bombay, this young guy, sort of my age, mid-30s guy, came up to me and he said, you know, I could have written your book. He said, I know all that stuff. And I just thought, you know, that's a sort of compliment. I mean, it's what he's saying is that the book expresses an experience that he feels that he shared, you know? And I think many people, when the book came out, reacted to it like that. Mm. That they saw it as a version of their own generation's story. It is a book about the generation of independence.
Yeah, it seems presumptuous when you first hear it, but actually it's the greatest compliment you could get, isn't it?
Yeah.
I could have written that book. Yeah. I get it.
Yeah. I know all that. That happened to me too, you know? And there was a journalist from Goa who came to interview me, and he handed me, in those primitive days, a carbon copy. Anybody remember what a carbon copy is? A carbon copy of chapter of a book he was writing. And it was a book which began with a boy in Goa born at midnight.
You know? Oh, no.
And he just said, you bastard, you finished your book before I did. You know?
And I could have won the Booker Prize.
You know, and it gave me this fantasy that all over India there were people writing the same book, you know. And I just was the person who finished first.
You're on Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart, and today we're at the Melbourne Writers' Festival talking to the Booker Prize-winning novelist Sir Salman Rushdie.
You came to Australia in 1982 with Midnight's Children, to the Adelaide Writers Festival.
84,
was it? And
yeah.
I think this is where you met the English writer Bruce Chatwin.
No, we came together.
Oh, you came together?
I knew Bruce from way back. And there was a group of us, Bruce Chatwin, Angela Carter, several other people came to Adelaide that year. And I had said to him, because I knew that he had been the year before for quite a long time travelling for what became the Songlines, and he wanted to go back to Alice Springs and do some more research. So I said, can I come with you? I said, you know, because I'd never been. I thought at least I'm going with somebody who kind of knows his way around. So that's what we did. We, at the end of the Adelaide Festival, we took a plane to the Alice.
And what did you do? What did you do in Alice Springs?
And the first thing we saw was a graffiti which said, surrender, white man, your town is surrounded. we rented a little four-wheel drive thing and drove around, you know, and I know it's now kind of blasphemous and forbidden and all that, climbed the rock. Or at least Bruce climbed the rock like a gazelle. I mean, he'd just been to Everest Base Camp. He was as fit as you could be. And I was sort of struggling. But anyway, yes, yeah. So we did that. And, I mean, it was very, very interesting. I've always thought that was, to me, the most interesting thing I've ever been able to do in Australia is to get out of the cities and go into the bush. And that was the first. I did actually do that again later with other people. But it was a great introduction.
And how did it strike you?
Well, I just thought it was like nowhere on earth, that landscape. You know, I thought it really was astonishing to see, because there's nothing in the world that looks like it.
You can't go to Alice Springs, or at least to Uluru, now without having a strong sense of its aboriginality.
Yeah.
Did you feel that back in 84?
Yes, yeah. And I mean, I met quite a lot of people who were sort of activists in various ways, and many of them didn't like Bruce. That was very odd, because I mean, he was the person who was taking me there, but many of them had very different politics than he did and thought that he was suspect.
You mean, and these are white people who didn't like him? Is that what you mean?
Well, white activists, lawyers and stuff, working with the Aboriginal community and so on. And they were a little guarded with me because I came with him. You know? And then eventually they decided that I was okay and not tainted with the kind of Chatwinian brush. And I think they did, all those people, and many of the people who are actually in some way in the songlines didn't really care for it that much, you know. I mean, I think it's a very interesting book, but I don't want to get into all that politics. But it was, yeah, I did meet a lot of people in the time I was there, both white and not white. It was enormously interesting to me, and I never really wrote about it because Bruce was writing about it, and I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to just sort of jump in and steal his subject, you know. So I've never written about it, but, you know, maybe I will.
So that's 84.
Yeah.
Well, you're just 5 years away from this big year, 89, which is a huge year in world affairs. It's the end of the Cold War. Mandela is released. There's Tiananmen Square. There's riots in Kashmir. And it's the year that the Satanic Verses makes you a hunted man. So the offending section of the novel has its genesis back actually when you were studying in Cambridge, when you discovered the incident of the Satanic Verses, which is the story of the temptation of Mohammed. Can you tell us what that story is? The story as you encountered it when you were a student in Cambridge.
Oh, well, it's, you know, it's very well authenticated. It's in a lot of the ancient traditions. And it is, as you say, it has parallels to stories that exist in the Old Testament and indeed the New Testament about the temptations of prophets. So even the Quran itself refers to the temptation of prophets, including of its own prophet. As far as one can tell, what happened was something like this, that in pre-Islamic Mecca, there were pagan deities, and three of the most popular were winged goddesses whose temples stood at the gates of the city and were run by the most powerful families in the city and were therefore very lucrative to those families because Mecca was a big trading city and people would come and go on these caravan trails and coming and going, they would make offerings at these temples, or as we would now say, pay taxes. And so the people running the temples were basically, you know, getting a very large amount of income from them. And it seems as if the Prophet Muhammad, who, after all, remember, was quite a successful businessman himself, didn't begin to prophesy until he was over 40, but was quite successful trading until that time, that he wanted his new religion that he was beginning to talk about to be accepted in the city and didn't like the idea that it wouldn't be. And it seems as if he was offered some kind of a deal. I mean, it seems as if he was told that if he could just incorporate these three winged goddesses into his pantheon, then the religion would be accepted. And I mean, you know, he didn't have to accept them, include them at the same level as God, but, you know, he already had winged creatures, you know, archangels and so on. So it was suggested that maybe if he had three more, but just these particular rather popular three more, then everything would be cool. So, I mean, there's a lot of supposition in this, but this seems to be something like what happened. Anyway, he goes up the mountain and he comes down and says that the angel Gabriel has given him the following verses. Have you heard of Al-Lat and Al-Manat and Al-Uzzah, the third, the other one? These are the exalted birds and their intercession is greatly to be desired. Right. Anyway, then we don't quite know what happens, but it seems as if there was a bit of a hullabaloo. It's quite possible that the faithful didn't like, or the newly faithful didn't like this reference to the pagan deities that they had just moved away from. It's possible that the city authorities ratted on the deal, you know, and didn't behave towards him as he would have wished. Anyway, we also don't know quite how long elapses, but what could have been days, weeks, or months later, he goes back up the mountain and comes back down saying that he had been deceived, that on the previous visit, the devil had appeared to him in the guise of the archangel. And the verses he had been given were therefore not from God, but from the devil.
They were satanic verses.
They were satanic verses. And that they should be expunged from the Quran, which they have been, and that they should be replaced with the following verses. And the new verses said, have you heard of Al-Lat and Al-Manat and Al-Uzzah, the third, the other one? These are but names that your forefathers invented and there is no truth in them. Shall God have daughters while you have sons? That would be an unjust division. Anyway, so those, if you look up the Quran, the chapter called The Star, Al-Najm, you will find those verses there now. So the Satanic Verses were expelled. Then there follows the persecution of Islam and eventually the flight to Medina and etc.
Yeah.
It seemed to me interesting that there was this moment of temptation with compromise and then a rejection of it. It seemed to me very interesting that one of the reasons given for the non-divinity of these pagan deities was their femaleness. Shall God have daughters while you have sons? And I thought, at the very least, that's interesting, you know, in a culture which has grown up enormously disadvantaging women. Sometimes it's interesting looking at the beginning. And if in the beginning we are being told emphatically that there is no way in which women can aspire towards the divine, you know, that may have something to do with the subsequent treatment of women, you know, in Islam. Anyway, it seemed to me, when I studied this at Cambridge in 1967, 68, I was 20, 21 years old, I thought, good story, you know, and sort of filed it away and 20 years later found out how good a story it was.
So, to be clear, what you're saying is that this story, which caused so much offence, yeah, is part of Islamic tradition. Yeah. You didn't invent it, you didn't make it up.
No.
Retold it, and actually is quite a small part in a much bigger story, which is actually a story of immigration.
That's right. I mean, one of the frustrating aspects of much of the attack on the Satanic Verses is that the people doing the attacking knew the Islamic tradition much less well than I did.
So why did it cause such offence?
Well, because there has been, in Islam, you may have noticed, a growing intolerance. One of the things that has been a weapon in the hands of the intolerant has been the resuscitation of these medieval offenses of blasphemy and heresy. You know? And I'm by no means the only person to be attacked in that way. You know, I mean, many people around the... Even at that time, the late 80s and early 90s, there were many writers, journalists, philosophers, you know, public figures across the Arab and Muslim world who were being accused of exactly the same offences, you know, blasphemy, heresy, insult, offence. And the point of this was the rise of political Islam trying to make sure that nobody said anything except what they approved of. And to have this... admittedly, I mean, I absolutely admit it, completely dissident view of the origin story of Islam presented in a novel was unacceptable to them. And I just point out that in the novel, the religion is not called Islam, the prophet's not called Muhammad, the city in which it takes place is not called Mecca. And the whole of this happens in dream sequences in the mind of somebody who's going insane. This is what we in the trade call fiction. All of that was stripped away from the attack on the novel, and the attack followed, and it was very effective.
So on St. Valentine's Day, 1989, you received news from a reporter.
Yeah, BBC reporter.
That you have been condemned to death by the Ayatollah.
Yeah, not good news.
Take us to that moment. What was that moment?
Well, I was sitting at home, you know. The point is the argument about the book had been going on for a while. I mean, this was 6 months after the book came out. I mean, the book came out in England in September 1988, you know, and this is now February 89. This is a month after the book burning in Bradford, which had really cranked things up to a much more dangerous level.
The very people you were writing about are burning your book.
Well, not Bradford. No, I wasn't writing about Yorkshire, but I was writing about, immigrant communities in East London. Yeah. So yeah, it was very upsetting and very angering, you know, because anybody involved in the world of books is well aware of the history of burning books, and well aware of where it leads, you know. There's a deep irony in the fact that the quotation that's always used about this subject, which is Heinrich Heine's famous line, where they burn books, they will afterwards burn people, which was used after the Kristallnacht and the book burnings in Germany. That line comes from Heinrich Heine's play Al-Mansur. And in his play, the book that is being burned, to which he objects, is the Quran. So this famous text about not burning books is actually a defense of the Quran against being burnt. And very strange that it should then be people on behalf of the Quran burning, you know, other books. Anyway, it was very upsetting to see book burning being revived. And, yeah, a month later, the escalation prophesied by Heiner, you know, took place. And, I was at home at my desk, and this woman from the BBC called up and said, "How does it feel to know that you've been condemned to death by the Ayatollah Khomeini?" It doesn't feel that good, you know. And I sort of ran around like an idiot locking the doors, you know. You know, as if that would help, you know. they then followed this kind of surrealist day, because I had agreed to do an interview with CBS television in America for their morning show. But, you know, obviously that's later. The morning is later in New York than it is in London. So this car showed up to take me to the CBS studios. And I thought, well, you know, I promised to go. And it's live television and I can't not go, so I better go. So I got in the car and went. And when I got there, you know, this was the big subject. Everybody was talking about it. And nobody knew what to make of it. I mean, on that day, nobody knew whether this was rhetoric, you know, just a bit of fist waving in my direction, or whether it was a real danger.
You know, the interview in which you said, "I wish I'd written a more critical book"?
Yeah. I'm rather proud of it. That say that at that moment, I thought, you know, good for you, kid. I thought. that much younger. I mean, I say kid because that was a person of, you know, whatever it was, 41. It's a long time ago. And very unfortunate, with bad hair and really terrible spectacles. You know, I could redo the look of that interview.
I love this. You just look at those YouTubes, you think, what were you thinking, Salman? The spectacles, the hair.
No, really, get a haircut and buy some decent glasses, you know. But even then, I mean, even the very experienced journalists who were at CBS that day didn't know how to read it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I remember asking, I can't remember his name, but there's a foreign correspondent guy who was there. I said, you know, what do you think this means? You know, and he said, oh, I wouldn't pay too much attention to it. He sentences the president of America to death every Friday. And of course, I kind of wanted to believe that. I wanted to think, oh, it's just a bit of saber rattling, you know. But it wasn't. And by the end of that day, I'd been approached by the police and
I've always assumed it wasn't, but do we know there were threats against you? I mean, is it possible that whole period of hiding and...
Well, I wish it were true, but unfortunately there were a lot of people.
Were there?
There were,
know that you're in real danger?
Well, about 2 days later, there was somebody who did what the police in their wonderful language scored an own goal. Where he blew himself up in a bed and breakfast place in Paddington, you know, and it seems clear that the bomb he was preparing wasn't supposed to blow himself up; it was supposed to blow somebody else up.
Mean it was meant for you?
Yeah, I mean there was very substantial numbers of people arrested and deported in that first year or two. Many of whom were received in Iran as heroes, by the way, when they got back. So it was quite clear the mission that they'd been on. There were also daily threats aimed at other people. I mean, it became very commonplace at Penguin Books for people to answer the phone and hear a voice saying, "We know where you live and we know where your children go to school." We know that there were daily threats in bookstores, in not just in England, but around the world, and there were bookstores that were firebombed. Some of them firebombed more than once, like Collett's bookstore in London was firebombed certainly twice. I think it may even have been firebombed three times. Cody's bookstore in Berkeley, California was firebombed, and other places in the world. I mean, this was a real attack. You know, the Italian translator of the Satanic Verses was attacked in his home, and kicked and knifed and beaten and was very lucky to live. The Japanese translator of the Satanic Verses was murdered at his university one night by an elevator shaft waiting for the elevator to arrive so he could go home. The Norwegian publisher of the Satanic Verses was shot in the back three times and again survived by a kind of miracle. So, yeah, I would like to be able to say that it was all make-believe, but it was not.
How many people do you reckon died as a direct result of this?
I don't know.
I mean, a recent article in Vanity Fair puts the number at 60.
Well, good for Vanity Fair. I mean, I don't know. They may be right. I mean, I think the problem is that a lot of people died in demonstrations in India and Pakistan, in which people didn't even know who I was. You know, they were just sent out, go and protest, and then, you know, the authorities took a rather brutal line. I mean, it was a terrible, terrible event, and it went on for well over a decade.
A lot of the book you've written, Joseph Anton, is about the friends who helped you, the succession of people who let you use their houses and apartments while you're in hiding. Because the weird part of this is that while you were in hiding and under police protection, you had to find the places where you stay.
Yes, no, this whole fiction of government safe houses, you know, which we all know from John le Carré, you know. I mean, if such places exist, they were not made available to me, you know. And it was made very clear to me that I had to find the places to stay, and at the same time, I had to remain unseen. So this, you know, creates a kind of logistical problem, you know. Invisible man rents house, you know. So, my friends were unbelievably helpful, including some Australian friends. Geoffrey Robertson and Kathy Lett were amongst the people who were very, very supportive in those years. It just really was nightmarishly difficult. At the same time, I didn't want to just be a kind of package, you know, being parceled out and hid but not able to act, you know. And so there was also a question of how to fight back, you know, how to resist a threat like this. And that took a little bit of time to work out. And again, I had individuals and human rights groups and so on who helped me very much to, in a way, to set up a defense campaign. And gradually that began to have some effect. Because initially, the attitude of the British government, this was the Thatcher government, which I had been quite critical of, their view was, well, we'll sort of protect him, but we're not going to kind of waste much time on him. You know, we'll just lock him up, but that's about it. Mm. And it took a very long time to get any kind of political momentum going. The one thing I do think could have been different is that if the government's attitude had been different, I think this thing could have been brought to an end much more quickly. As was shown by the fact that the thing that actually did allow it to come to an end was literally three changes of government. Let's say that the arrival of the Blair government. I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to say some positive things about the Blair government, about which I've been, in many other ways, critical. But the election of the Blair government in England, the election of President Clinton in the United States, and the arrival in Iran of the Khatami government, which was a regime which really wanted to sort of ameliorate relationships with the West. So suddenly having the Labour government in England meant that instead of there being this bunch of Tories who thought I was an asshole, essentially, there were Labour politicians who I knew. Like, I knew them, you know, like first name basis. I'd known them forever and ever. Robin Cook, the Foreign Secretary, and people like that. I mean, I was not particularly a great friend of Blair's, but I did know people in the Foreign Office, and they'd been Robin Cook, Derek Thatcher, too, was the Deputy Minister in the Foreign Office. These were people I'd known for a long time. So suddenly, I was a friend as opposed to an enemy. And it's true that Robin Cook and Derek Thatcher at the Foreign Office just said, we're going to fix this. We're just going to do it. You know, and told me that more or less within the first weeks of their coming into office. And Blair was very supportive too, I have to say. And then Clinton was supportive. And the fact that it was made clear to the Iranians that they were not going to be able to get around this issue, you know, that it was not going to get swept under the carpet, and that they were going to have to deal with it. The moment they understood that that was really the case, you know, they're actually very pragmatic. Mm. They thought, let's deal with it. And so they did, and there was an agreement at the United Nations which did a great deal to sort of remove the threats. So I've always felt that if that spirit had been there in the British and American governments, you know, back in 89, 90, maybe this could have been dealt with earlier, but these are all, you know, maybes and what ifs. And one of the great things you learn in the study of history is never ask the question, what if? Not interesting. Mm. It's hard enough to understand why things happened as they did without trying to work out how they would have happened, how it would have been if they'd happened another way.
You're on Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart, and today we're at the Melbourne Writers' Festival talking to the Booker Prize-winning novelist Sir Salman Rushdie.
Now, when the book Joseph Anton first came out, you and I spoke on Radio National, and you talked very candidly about the low points of that period in seclusion, about the time you apologised, declaring that you were a repentant Muslim. But the abiding impression I had from that conversation was of your astonishing strength and your resolve. And it goes to the question, what did you believe in so passionately that meant that you kept going? I mean, what you're believing in is a novel. And there were plenty of people who said, Salman, just withdraw the novel. It's not worth this. It's just a book. For heaven's sake, man, withdraw the novel. Yeah. Why was that not the right answer?
That would have been cowardly, craven, disgusting, and shameful. That's why. and you know, the history of literature is one in which writers have defended their work. You know, and I wasn't going to be the one who didn't. But you're right, the question that I had to ask myself, if somebody's trying to kill you because of something you've said or written or whatever, you have to ask yourself if it's worth dying for.
Yes, it's a novel. No? Is a novel worth all this?
Well, two things are worth all this. One is a principle of freedom of speech, which goes long way beyond my own book. You either have it or you don't. You know, you lose the freedoms you don't defend. And I thought that was probably worth fighting for. And the other was the question of terrorism. And it seemed to me that if you give in to terrorism, you guarantee that there will be more of it. You know, you don't make peace with it. It doesn't go away. You by surrendering to it, you make sure that it will happen again and again and again. And so it seemed to me that there were two things that were having to be defended. One was the right of people in free societies to say what they chose without being physically endangered because of the attitudes of medievalist tyrants in other countries. You know, that was one thing. And the other thing was just this very high principle of the freedom of speech without which all other freedoms disappear. And to have to, and if you're like me and you're a kind of writer who's essentially satirical by nature, it's much easier to know the things that you are against than the things that you stand for, you know. And in this case, what I was against was pretty damn easy. You know, somebody's tried to kill me, I was against it. you know, should you be killed because you wrote a book somebody didn't like? My answer to that, my view is that that's a yes-no question, you know. And for the record, my answer is no, you know. So that part was easy. What was more difficult and necessary and serious was to try and work out what I thought we were defending, you know. And I did. I mean, I think I did, and I think that's what I've just said is what I believe. Mm. I mean, I also think, by the way, that it's a damn good novel. And one of the things you weren't allowed to do at that point was to use, I mean, the defense that's been used historically against on behalf of books that have been under attack has been the quality defense. You know, the quality defense was used for Lady Chatterley's Lover, in which many people said they perjured themselves, said it was a great novel, but they did so to kind of, you know, win the case. The quality defense was used for Lolita and for Ulysses and for any number of, you know, books that have been attacked in different ways. In this case, it for some reason seemed to be the case that the quality defense was not admissible. You know, you could not defend this novel on the basis that it was a good novel. That didn't seem like an adequate defense. In fact, it seemed very easy for people to say what a crappy novel it was, which was usually proved by the fact they hadn't read it. You know, I haven't read it, so I don't like it. Anyway, I felt that just quietly, privately, I was also hoping for the quality defense to rear its head. And what I'd like now, that we're so many years down the line, I mean, this is a very long time ago, you know, it's a quarter of a century ago, is that people are finally able to read that novel as a novel, you know, and not just as a kind of some kind of political hot potato. You know, with Lady Chatterley, you would pick up copies and they would automatically fall open at the pages that the trouble was about. And with this book, I know any number of people who've read it, and they said, "Well, why, we can't see where's the problematic bit?" You know. And it's just nice that it's finally getting its chance to be a novel. You know, and what happens is what happens to novels. Some people love it, some people like it, some people don't like it much, some people don't like it at all. That's the ordinary life of a novel. Mm. You know, and it's finally able to have that life, and that. Just, you know, speaking as the author of the novel, that was worth fighting for too.
When did you decide to resume public life?
Well, I mean, it wasn't like overnight. It wasn't like throwing a switch. It happened gradually. You know, I mean, I had to argue with the British police a long time for the most elementary bits of liberty, and certainly argue with them a great deal before they would agree that I could do anything. Like this, you know, anything like publicly talking about my work. And initially, of course, those events were done with kind of almost comical amounts of security. So it was step by step, you know, and it was easier in America than it was in England for a long time. So remember, this was pre-9/11 America, which I think, in a way, I benefited from because Americans weren't so worried about international terrorism then, as they are now. So I was given a lot of leeway, you know, and people weren't that bothered that I was there.
So you're breathing a little easier, but now in 2014, it does seem to me that theocratic ideologies are more vigorous than ever.
Yeah.
Well, do you think that's right? And if you do, what do you think is fueling this period of religious militancy?
Well, I think religious militancy is fueling it. You know, and I think it's not an effect; it's a cause.
But it's come from somewhere. It hasn't been.
You're talking to a really quite well-known atheist. My belief is that religion fucks things up. You know, I mean, Christopher Hitchens famously wrote a book which tried to explain this. God is not great. The rise of fanaticism across the Islamic world is not for a single cause. You know, it's different in different places. The reason why Shia fanaticism arose in Iran is not the same thing as the rise of ISIS in Iraq. You know, which is for a start Sunni, and hates Shias. You know. The reason for the rise of Algerian militancy is not the same thing as the reason for the rise of the Taliban. You know, these are related but different. You know, Boko Haram, Al Shabaab. They all have Islam behind them, but they don't come from exactly the same place. If you wanted to look for a single cause, I would say that probably the greatest single error of 20th century Western diplomacy was putting the Saud family in charge of the oil. Because what then happened was that this particular extremist version of Islam, Wahhabism, and its relative Salafi Islam, which is the most violent, fanatical version of Islam, was given the colossal benefit of gigantic financial investment because of the oil money. And all these groups, Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, ISIS, Taliban, every single one of these groups comes out of Salafism. You know, and Salafism has been solely and massively sponsored by the government of Saudi Arabia. for the last generation and more. So if you want to look for a source place, look in the kingdom, you know. And the idea that Saudi Arabia is somehow our ally is a laughing stock of an idea. This is the place which all the, you know, it's well known that in the aftermath of 9/11, the Bush administration airlifted a whole bunch of Saudis out of America and sent them back. Well, who were those people? Why were they airlifted out? It's very, very fishy what the Saudis have been up to. Look at who was on the planes that hit the America. The very, very large majority of them were Saudi citizens. That's the center of where it's come from. But the reason it has developed appeal is different in different parts of the world.
So now we're wondering, I guess everyone in this room is wondering, so are there solutions? Are there something the West could do?
Well, you know, I don't know. You know, look, I'm a novelist.
Right.
You know, don't ask me to solve the problems of the world. It's hard enough to express the problems of the world. But I will say that one of the things I look at is what happened in Britain during the time of the IRA bombing campaign, the provisional IRA. And the reason why the IRA were forced to peace negotiations and were in the end obliged to give up the path of violence was not external pressure. You know, the reason was that the Catholics of Northern Ireland got sick of it. You know, they got sick of living in a war zone. They got sick of all the paraphernalia that came with the attempt to resist the IRA. And it was their own people who forced them to put down the weapons. You know, and there then followed the peace dividend, so-called, where there was a large degree of investment in Northern Ireland and people's lives began to get better. And it rapidly became clear to people that that's what they wanted. They didn't want to go back to that old world of bombs and so on. So, I mean, you can't easily translate one part of the world to another, but it seems to me that experience shows me that that's where it has to come from. You know, that's where it has to come from.
Well, what do you make of the fact that the killer of the journalist James Foley seems to have been British?
Yeah, I make of it the same thing you do. I mean, it's you know, there's a very scary statistic that I read last week about that there were more young British Muslims who had joined the jihadists than had joined the British armed forces. You know, now, if that's the case, then, wow, you know, that's scary. I mean, I had, like many people, I had thought that race relations in England were much improved from the time that I wrote the Satanic Verses. You know, when at that time in the 80s, it really wasn't a good time for race relations. There was a lot of racial tension. And I had felt in the next 15, 20 years, you know, that things had actually improved a great deal in England. And that much of this had been defused. But what's now clearly happened, in certainly amongst sections of the British Muslim community, is that there is this frighteningly radical jihadist ideology that's beginning to attract a lot of support.
Well, you've been very generous and very candid over this past hour. Would you thank Salman Rushdie?
And that's Books and Arts Daily for today, coming to you from the Melbourne Writers' Festival. Tomorrow, I'll bring you my conversation with Ian McEwan, the English novelist. He's back with a new book. It's called The Children Act. It's about judges in the family court and a personal life unravelling. Coming up now, it's Bush Telegraph with Cameron Wilson, or Big Ideas if you're listening at night.
The Science Show will be 39 this week, but I'm not sure you should listen to our 39th birthday programme after all. Consider, I interview a man at length who can't speak. Then we learn about an adventure 102 years ago that ended in death and disappointment. And finally, we hear from a forester aged 90. So why listen? Well, I think you'll be surprised. And you can download the 39th birthday programme by going to the RN website.